Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love. CMF Curo is the country's first Catholic health share ministry to provide an affordable health sharing program rooted in Catholic teaching and community. Learn more at mycatholichealthshare.com. CMF Curo. Healthcare fully alive.
Good evening and welcome to Beneath the Surface here on WCAP Radio. Keep that music going, Cindy. Why do you cut it off? Glad you could join us tonight, my fellow truth seekers. Beneath the Surface, where faith and reason meets every Monday evening between 10 and 11 p.m., bringing a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little light into our culture of death. We are broadcasting live here at the WCAP studios at 980 a.m., which is live streamed on TuneIn as well as WCAP.com, and will end up being podcasted on sites throughout the internet. Again, thanks for joining us tonight. Before I introduce to you my topic, let's introduce to you my guest. Woohoo! Ever hear that? Do you remember that old game show, What's My Line?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Barely, but I remember it.
Yeah, so it's too bad this wasn't video, because I would have you come on here and sign in.
Oh.
And then have people guess who you are.
And they would never guess.
I guess that wouldn't work. There he is, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Bob LeBlanc. Bob, being you is like what?
Being me is like suffering and joy all mixed together.
Really? A good combo of suffering and joy, huh?
Yeah, mostly on the joy side for this period of last week, but a little bit of suffering last week.
Do you think you can have joy in this life without suffering?
I can't imagine, you know, this life on Earth not having any suffering. It just seems to be the thing.
Kind of keeps you in line sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah. No, it really does.
That could be a whole BTS show. That isn't our topic, but you want to comment on that?
Well, I just wanted to mention, you know, this past autumn here, or leading up to the election, I was knocking on doors. And the thing that I wanted to bring up is that I got bit by a dog.
Now that is a little bit of a suffering, huh?
That is a little bit of a suffering. But it turned out as time went on, you know, I saw that as a blessing from God. A lot of things changed after the dog bit me.
Wow.
You know, I went to the hospital and the doctors and nurses all started freaking out, not because of the dog bite, but for other reasons.
Ah.
And
they saw in you some things that you did not realize.
That I did not realize, some things that were not being treated and now are being treated.
Mm.
And, you know, because I've been walking around a lot and knocking on doors, I lost a whole bunch of weight.
Cool.
As well as a change in diet and...
Wow.
So things are happening in a good sense, and it was all due to what you would think is suffering.
It's a dog bite, yeah.
Yeah, the dog bite.
And I guess that was my original point, that sometimes suffering keeps us in line. It
yes.
Yeah. It enables us to live in a better way than we would have if we didn't suffer, because we tend to be a very obsessive and addictive species.
Yeah. We tend toward the lazy, sort of pleasurable sort of things.
The life
of
vice.
Yes. I think if we had our druthers, a lot of us would just be a couch potato sitting watching TV, you know?
Yes. It's good that we don't have our druthers.
Yes.
All right. 978-454-4980 is the VTS hotline. And tonight's topic is going to be that of Veterans Day and World War One.
Talking about suffering.
Yeah, speaking about suffering. Veterans Day and World War One. Yesterday was the 100th anniversary of the end of World War One. Bob, you are our amateur historian, so that's why we bring you on tonight. And could you just give us a little, just a concise understanding of the relationship between Veterans Day, what we celebrate, and the world in World War One? What is the relationship?
Okay, so after World War One, we began to celebrate Armistice Day.
Armistice Day, yeah.
Yeah. So, and that day was on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month.
A lot of 11s.
A lot of 11s, and that's the way people remember when it specifically occurred. And actually, you can go on the internet and you can listen to a recording of the last minutes of World War One at a specific location. And you hear all the shellings and the artillery going off and the booms and a few machine gun fires, but mostly it's artillery. And then when 11 o'clock hits, it becomes quiet. And then after a little bit, you start hearing the birds sing and stuff like that.
Who recorded this?
I don't remember.
Okay,
there wasn't
a narrator speaking.
No. There was it was a video with a little bit of indication of the minute mark when things were, you know, when 11 o'clock occurred.
Yeah.
And then you started hearing everything stopped. You know,
okay.
And it was interesting that the Allies and the Germans had agreed to the armistice at 5 o'clock in the morning, and they said what's going to happen at 11. So everything continued on as if the war were going full bore. I mean, there were assaults that happened. A lot of people died on that day.
Between 5 and 11?
Between 5 and 11.
Man, what a waste of lives.
Yes, and
why couldn't they just say, let's end it now?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was maybe kind of a trust sort of thing, you know, is like we have to agree on the time so that one side doesn't, you know, take advantage of the other.
Okay.
And make sure the word gets out, this is the time that we stop.
All right, what I'd like to do in this show is begin by going beneath the surface, and then...
Oh, I wanted to continue with this.
Okay, go up to a more historical perspective.
Sure.
Did you want to finish your thought here?
Yes, I did. What happened was that originally it was called Armistice Day in the United States until after World War II, when veterans petitioned, the government, you know, President Eisenhower was president at that time, and it became November 11th became Veterans Day, and so they celebrate all veterans.
So it originated as a celebration of the end of World War One, and then it blossomed into a celebration of all veterans.
Right.
And that's what we celebrate today.
Right. Not to be confused with Memorial Day, which is the fallen, you know, fallen veterans.
The fallen veterans. Veterans Day is just all veterans.
All veterans, yes.
Okay. And, of course, today is special because it's the 100th anniversary of the end. Of Armistice Day, basically.
Right. 1918 was the year that it ended. We're 2018 now.
Okay. What is war?
What is war?
Yeah.
Well,
war is people fighting each other, isn't it?
Right. It's violence to achieve some sort of end.
Yeah. Why do people fight?
Well, there are lots of reasons. The more base reasons is that you want to have some sort of gain.
Gain. Okay.
You want to have control over some other country for whatever reason.
War is basically two groups of people fighting, right?
Usually,
War is considered like two communities fighting each other.
Or two sides.
But, I mean, at the smallest unit of fighting are two individuals, right?
Yeah, but here we're at the governmental level.
Yeah, I'm getting there.
Oh, okay.
So war is fighting.
Uh-huh.
You have individuals who fight each other.
Right.
That has been around since human history, since we know.
Right, right. Started with Cain and Abel, you know?
Cain and Abel because of envy. So
yeah.
there's one reason why humans fight. Then, of course, there was tribal warfare.
Right.
And
yeah.
That's of two small communities fighting each other over usually territory and goods.
Yeah, or resources of some sort. You know, you saw out of envy, you saw that they had more goods than you did, or the grass, for whatever reason, seemed greener on the other side, and you're going to go and take whatever they had.
And that kind of thing, that kind of tribal warfare, of course, was around forever until the city-state began to emerge.
Right, for protection, yes.
And then nature. So, what kind of species are we that we... It's so common that we are willing to kill other people in order to take goods and properties.
Yeah, we are a fallen
race. What
does
that say about the human race?
It's kind of irrational, and I think in our discussion today, we're going to see that it was really irrational. We can do certainly a better way to go about these things, but we don't often choose that way.
Well, when two individuals have disagreements, what do they first do?
Hopefully they talk.
If they're reasonable people, they will confront each other in a friendly way, right?
Yeah.
And say, I don't understand why you're doing this. Can we talk about it? Let's try to understand this problem.
Yes.
And so...
But that doesn't always work, because one person may just say, you know, whatever, I'm not going to listen to you.
Well, that's the problem. That's the evil.
Yeah.
But if there wasn't that evil in the human heart, people would reason things out, come to an understanding, and give to the other what is due. Basically, that's what justice means,
right? What justice means, yes.
Yeah. All right, so we're a fallen race, which means that we, by virtue of original sin, we now look more inward than look for the common good.
Right.
That selfishness festers itself, and it festers itself not only as individuals, but whatever community you're in, right? The family, the clan, the tribe.
Right.
And now today, in modern times, the nation.
Well, you know, the sometimes the common good is a little bit confused, because
yes.
it's when you're talking about a national level or a tribal level, usually the common good is seen as, you know, my tribe's common
yes.
good and my nation's common good or my country's common good.
Absolutely.
To the exclusion of all the others.
That's how it's always been, hasn't it?
Yes.
It's funny how Jesus said in the New Testament, it used to be said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, but I say turn the other cheek and love your enemy.
Loving your enemies is so hard.
And Jesus said, it used to be said, love your countrymen and your tribesmen or your family men, but I say, love your neighbor, love your enemies as you love yourself.
Yeah, tough.
Do good to those who persecute you. Pray for those who do harm to you. It's it universalizes
right.
Our notion of the common good. Do you think we have, as a human race, do you think we have gotten to that point where we have assimilated in our minds and hearts that universalization of the common good yet?
I see it as sometimes maybe two steps forward, one step back kind of thing. There are certain things you can point to and say, yeah, you know, like we've got a United Nations
yes.
to try to help things and stuff. And then you look at the United Nations these
yes.
days and you say, is it really helping, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, it's a mixed bag, I think.
And before we get into the historical stuff, a lot of people today are saying, countries like the United States, Russia, maybe a couple of others now, are looking more inwards than they used to, and
yep.
they're labeling it nationalism.
Right.
Do you think this is a step backward, or do you think it's actually a good movement?
Well, yeah, it depends on what you mean by nationalism, because nationalism can be seen as a synonym for patriotism, which
That's
just
right.
really means a love of country.
Or fascism.
Right?
The national socialism is where the, you look at that, and you know, of course, national socialism touted the superiority of the German nation.
Right.
So that's the perverted sort of nationalism that we're talking about.
So you don't think strong patriotism is a negative thing? You don't see it as people looking inward rather than understanding the universality of the common good, like we talked about earlier.
Well, I think the Catholic Church is right in applauding love of country, because that's just an extension of love of neighbor.
Okay.
So, but of course,
does it exclude the love of neighbor outside of one's country?
No, it does not.
Okay.
It's just that it makes sense that a person would love his family, you know, more than the strangers that are around him, or he loves his country more than he loves other countries. Loving who you are is not necessarily a bad thing.
Can I make a distinction there?
Sure.
Some people would say that means that you believe that your country is, the people in your country are more valuable than the people in other countries, by saying that you love them more. But that's not what you're saying,
no,
is it?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that those people that you interact with on a continual basis, your own culture, those sorts of things, those are good things to love. I mean, there's certain things in a culture that you point... In fact, love of country, love of culture actually should impel you to point out when things are wrong within your family, within your country, within your culture. So that's a proper kind of love. It's not a I love no matter what happens kind of thing.
I think a potential problem is looked at historically, that too much of a love of country often used to equate to hate of other countries.
Right. People kind of had this polar view.
Yes.
So I love my country, therefore I need to hate all these other countries.
Exactly.
But that's not necessarily true, but it does happen.
And that's a problem with nationalism. No?
Yeah. And okay. I guess you could call it a problem with patriotism as well.
Yeah.
You know.
Right. A potential problem.
Yes.
It's taking something that's good and making a vice out of it, or perverting.
Right. And of course, we could make a distinction between an ordered love and a disordered love.
Right.
And disordered loves are all those sorts of things that we talk about as sin. I mean, there's a lot of things that we love in a disordered way that we should not be doing. You know.
And I think a problem with us humans is that once we recognize that something can be perverted, and a lot of people pervert it, then you throw it out completely.
Yes.
In other words, you throw away the baby with the bathwater instead of just trying to purify the goodness of the original thing.
Well, you do see that, I think, a little bit on the left, where they say, a person says, "I love my country," and they go, "Oh, you're a Nazi. You're loving your country way too much." And that's not true. I mean, that you don't need to throw away love of country in order not to be, you know, a fascist of some sort.
All right. So then, could I look at it as one's family is an extension of oneself?
Right.
And one's nation or one's country is an extension of one's family?
Right.
Okay. And then one could probably go the next step and say the world is an extension of that.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, it's all circles, starting with you as the individual, working out to all mankind.
All right. 978-454-4980 is the BTS hotline. If you want to be included in our conversation, we'd love to have you. 978-454-4980. Paul Morano on Beneath the Surface, speaking with my guest, Bob LeBlanc, my amateur historian on Veterans Day and World War One, the 100th anniversary of the end of World War One. Okay, so, Bob, let's get into World War One.
Sure.
Now, a very elementary question would be, what led up to it, and what was going on in the world before World War One, and How did tensions arise?
Okay. Well, the first thing is to try to understand Europe, because Europe is really what created World War One. Europe has been expanding into other continents for several centuries now, and so it's really kind of an age of empires. You know, Europe is very popular, powerful, and you know, various countries of Europe are thinking, oh, how do I develop my empire? They're trying to catch up with the British Empire that really, you know, circled the entire globe with their empire.
At what point was Europe called Europe?
Oh,
or recognized as a continent?
I'm not really sure about that. I think that happened probably sometime maybe around the Middle Ages, but I can't be sure about that.
Okay.
You know, it wasn't... you have to remember that the Roman Empire, that it was around the Mediterranean, which included, you know, Africa and the Middle East, as
right.
well as Europe.
Right. Rome was, of course, the center of the Roman Empire.
Right, which was in Europe.
Which is in Europe, yeah.
The center of the world kind of shifted with the barbarian invasions, and then Islam, you know, took basically all of northern Africa away from Christendom.
Okay. St. Augustine, of course, was from northern Africa.
One of the greatest
saints of the Catholic Church.
He was from northern Africa, and all the Christians really disappeared after the Muslim invasions. You know, there's a small Christian presence in those African nations, but it's really dominated by Islam. So,
okay.
Christianity or Christendom was centered around Europe, and it was kind of like a shared culture that came from the disintegration of Rome.
A shared culture?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, basically due to Christianity. I mean, you had different... there were basically Germanic peoples, a lot of Germanic languages, and then from the countries that were formerly part of the Roman Empire, those were Romance languages. And of course, there were the Slavs. There was another kind of grouping.
Well, was there always a tension between the Romance countries and the Germanic countries?
No, not really. I think the tensions were of the sort, I'm the king of this country and I want to expand, and so tensions started from that kind of thing. It wasn't really between Romance and Germanic.
Okay. So before World War One, what was going on?
Okay, so the Industrial Revolution happened, and it was, you know, a time of expansion. Before that, you had Columbus discovering the New World, and so you had the European powers, you know, expanding into the New World. And then, you know, the Industrial Revolution happened, and so there was this technological edge. And they started dividing up the rest of the world. China was a victim nation. The Chinese Empire was being carved up. The continent of Africa was being carved up, except for the parts that were under Islamic control. Like Africa was pretty much carved up. It was taken away from Islam.
But it was for earthly and it was for the greater material benefit, not necessarily spiritual evangelization.
Right.
Is that fair to say?
You know, I think you could say, honestly, Columbus wanted to evangelize, you know, the rest of the world, and he was planning on doing that through his voyages, but. Yeah, I think the Europeans from there on just said conquest, gold, you know,
materials. Right, that got the best of them. Okay.
That got the best of them, yeah.
Okay.
And so, you know, this is, so you see this expansion of power. You had Great Britain and France with the head start on this. You had some nations falling down, like Spain. the Spanish-American War kind of carved up the former Spanish Empire, you had two new nations, Germany and Italy. They were going, hey, what about us? You know, so they're thinking of trying to start up their empire. You had the dying empire, the dying Ottoman Empire, and the dying Russian Empire.
And all of these, well, I tell you what, we'll stop right here because of the break. We need to take a quick break, and we will be back here on Beneath the Surface with my guest, Mr. Bob LeBlanc. And Cindy is behind the glass doing all the music, commercials, and all the important stuff. So don't go away. We'll be right back here on Beneath the Surface. We're back. Beneath the Surface, WCAP. Until 11 o'clock, my guest tonight is Mr. Bob LeBlanc. And we're talking about the topic of Veterans Day and World War One. Today is the 100th anniversary of Armistice Day, the end of the big, great war. At least it was billed as the War of Wars that will render all other wars unnecessary.
Well, the war to end all wars, yes.
And by the end of the show, we are going to talk to Bob about why that didn't happen. But anyway, 978-454-4980 is our phone number if you want to chime in. So before the break, Bob, we were talking about some of the things that were beginning to occur politically and socially in Europe that led up to tensions that led up to World War One. Want to continue?
Sure. Well, to cover the one empire that we haven't talked about yet is Austria-Hungary, the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Okay.
It was really a Germanic sort of empire, kind of the remnant of the Holy Roman Empire. Really, Germany was the Holy Roman Empire, but Germany became a nation on its own, and then Austria-Hungary kind of combined to make its own sort of empire. And Austria-Hungary was just the polyglot of all these different nations.
Okay.
You know, they had Czechoslovakia's in there, Serbia's in there, parts of Romania are in there, obviously Austria and Hungary.
Bosnia?
Bosnia, which was part of Serbia.
Okay.
So you had this entire kind of mix. And Austria-Hungary was a fairly weak empire.
It wasn't as strong as the nation of Germany at that time.
Germany was an up-and-coming empire, you know, a lot of people were getting afraid of Germany, and so...
Because they were becoming more powerful?
Becoming more powerful.
All right.
They had just beat France in the 19th century, you know, the late 19th century, and, you know, they were kind of stretching their muscle around and stuff, and so you had countries like Great Britain and France uniting, you know, mm-hmm. they were enemies, you know, for a long, long time, and now they're uniting. you know, so you have these various empires. We talked about the Ottoman Empire is kind of like the sick man of Europe. And the Austria-Hungary was really kind of fragile, you know. And what happened was is that their heir apparent, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, was assassinated by a Bosnian nationalist.
Why?
They wanted to be, you know, they wanted to have a free sort of Serbian nation that was all together. I mean, there was a country called Serbia, but they wanted, it was part of it was owned by Austria-Hungary.
So they felt that they were like a satellite of the Soviet Union that shouldn't be there, right? They should be a country of their own.
They wanted to be a complete country of their own, and so you had...
So the Archduke was the Archduke of the Austria-Hungary Empire at the time?
Right. He was... Yeah, well, he was the heir apparent. He was... a duke of a particular part of Austria, I think, or something like
and,
that.
And assassinating him? I mean, he wasn't the king or the leader, right?
He wasn't the king, but he was the next in line. Okay. To become
So something serious.
Something serious. And
is this what is known as the shot that's heard around the world?
No, that was the Revolutionary War in Concord and Lexington.
Gotcha. Okay. I was getting the two
phrases
mixed up.
But this was a similar sort of thing because it triggered a whole series of events.
Yes.
The thing to understand now is that we had interlocking alliances that were happening because of this, because people were afraid of Germany, and based on their own self-interest. So you had on one side the Triple Entente, which was Great Britain, France, and Russia.
Okay.
They were saying, "Hey, we got to do what we need to do to contain things."
Okay.
And Austria-Hungary hitched its wagon to Germany and said, "Oh,
okay."
Yes. And a late comer to this was Italy. Italy was a brand new nation. Mm-hmm. You know, it was previously all chopped up in the Papal States and various sort of principalities, and it was finally united. And they said, "Okay, we're gonna kind of maybe do an alliance with Germany." But Italy was kind of not really solidly in that corner.
Okay.
It actually made a secret alliance with France, and it turned out that when war came, Italy did not join what was called the Triple Alliance, which was Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Italy.
Okay.
So what happens is that the Archduke is assassinated, and his wife. They were both assassinated in their car.
All right.
You know, Austria-Hungary, said, this is Serbia's fault here.
Okay.
Because it was a Bosnian-Serbian national that was that assassinated the Archduke. And they made impossible demands. They wanted an excuse to invade Serbia.
Ah.
You know.
So instead of going after the people that did it,
they did. They got. Okay. I think they caught the assassinating guy,
okay.
the assassin. But it, you know, it was a pretext to even, because I mean, you had, you know, outbreaks of violence that were happening in Austria-Hungary,
okay.
that was due to all this various nationalism, and they just said,
right.
you know.
But are you saying that it was an excuse for Austria and Hungary to take over Serbia more so?
Yeah.
Or was it an excuse for Germany to invade?
Austria-Hungary, well, so the Ottoman Empire is basically falling apart, and so the Balkans became free. And Austria-Hungary is looking at the Balkans and saying, good territory for the Austria-Hungary Empire here.
Okay.
And so they want to kind of expand into the Balkans.
All right. And they try.
And so they have an excuse. They go to Serbia and they make a list of impossible demands on
All
Serbia.
Right. Yeah.
So Serbia obviously says no can do.
Mm.
And so, you know, this is where the interlocking alliances come in. So Russia goes and says, well, Serbia is our friend.
Mm.
And so Russia mobilizes. So Austria-Hungary attacks Serbia.
Okay.
They start doing artillery fire on Belgrade, on the capital of Serbia. And Russia says, okay, we're going to mobilize. And Germany, because they're allied with Austria-Hungary, goes, no, Russia.
Yeah.
If you mobilize, we're going to mobilize.
Mm.
And so when that happens, France jumps in and says, okay, no, we're in alliance with Russia.
Yeah.
So if you mobilize, we're going to mobilize.
Right.
So this chain reaction happens. And so Germany is starting to mobilize. And it looks and it says, well, Russia's pretty weak. And France is pretty strong comparatively.
Okay.
So we're going to attack France. We're going to put the bulk of our army against France, but we're going to flank them. we're going to go through Belgium, you know. Mm. And Germany says, Belgium, please, let our armies go through. And Belgium says, no way.
Ah.
And so they say, well, we're going to go through anyways.
Okay.
And so Belgium getting invaded trips the Great Britain coming into the war.
Ah, so Great Britain over the West. They said, okay, now it's time for us to jump in.
So there's the basic initial alignment that happens.
Okay.
And so the interesting part is Germany goes and invades through Belgium and goes into France, and they get a lot of territory. And then, you know, contrary to their expectations of winning a quick war, and in fact, all the big powers at this time thought, we're going to be done with this in 4 weeks.
Right.
You know, and they start digging trenches, and it just becomes very, very static on the Western Front. It just becomes trenches, artillery fire.
Mostly Germany and France at this point?
The Great Britain gets some an expeditionary force into France.
Okay, right.
So you have Great Britain active in France, and they're also getting active in other areas as well as time moves on.
So the main theater was in France, but then it spread.
Well, of course, you know, there was a theater in the east between Russia and Germany.
Okay.
But Russia was really weak.
Yeah.
So even though Germans didn't have a lot of forces there, Russia was still having problems maintaining their front.
Right.
And Austria-Hungary was sort of weak as well. They were kind of blindsided. They thought Germany was going to put its forces into Russia, and it turns out Germany was really going after France, and so Austria-Hungary has to go on a two-front war with Russia and Serbia as well.
Now, you said that before World War I, France and Germany fought?
Yes.
What was the name of that war?
It wasn't really Germany. The Prusso-Franco War.
Okay.
The Franco-Prussian War. Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
So it was really, Prussia was the kind of the kingdom that really was the base of Germany uniting.
Okay, so these two peoples are familiar with fighting each other at this point.
Yes, okay. Yes.
All right. So here they are. They're at it again. It escalates, and you begin to have the Axis powers versus...
Well, there was an Axis.
The Allied powers.
You had the Triple Entente, which was we would call the Allies in World War II.
Okay, yeah.
And the Central Powers is what the Triple Alliance eventually became called.
Okay.
As time went on, the war spread to other parts of Europe. In fact, it's worldwide because Germany had possessions in Africa and in China.
Okay. Japan got involved.
Japan got involved. Yeah, it was going, you know, we can get a little bit of something from Germany. Germany's not going to be able to have its holdings in China. So we're going to go and starve up some stuff in China for ourselves. So they joined, you know, Great Britain and France on that.
So it was kind of an all-out, let's get what we can kind of thing.
Yes, yes. It was very much that, you know.
Right. So how long did it last?
It lasted a little more than 4 years.
From 1914 to 1918.
Yes.
When did the United States say, hey, let's get involved, and why?
Okay, so the United... we have to get a little bit of technology. The Germans didn't really have a great surface fleet. They were building a big fleet, and Great Britain was really worried about their fleet. But it wasn't as big as Great Britain's fleet. And so... The Germans said, where can we get an advantage? And they developed the submarine, the U-boats.
Okay.
They weren't as flashy as the World War II U-boats, but they could get the job done.
Were there submarines before World War I?
Yes, they were. Okay. They were being developed during this time frame.
All right.
And so they said, we're being starved out by the British fleet, So we're going to starve out Great Britain with our U-boats. And they started with that program. They did unrestricted submarine warfare, which basically meant not just going after warships, but going after civilian merchant ships that were carrying foods and ammunition. And
stuff. These are the Germans we're talking about.
Where Germans are doing that.
All right.
And the United States was going, no, 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 you can't do that.
Yeah,
That's bad stuff. And the United States was neutral. It wanted to stay out of the European wars, following upon George Washington's advice to stay out of these European wars.
Right.
And
there was a great ocean between them, and there was no mass media, right? What was there for communications?
There was newspapers, and they were you know, good for pretty comparable to this time period, you know.
But how did they get from across the ocean?
Well, you had the transatlantic telegraph sort of thing, so
All right.
You were able to get news from Europe.
Okay,
you didn't have to wait for the ship to sail and provide news. And so, you know, but the United States was really isolationist when it came to this war. It didn't really want to get involved, but several things happened. One was the unrestricted warfare. The Lusitania was sunk in 1915. It was a British ship, Royal RMS Lusitania. And you know, it had, like, I think 128 Americans on there. And so that caused a little uproar for the United States. And then also, Germany was trying to get the Mexicans
Mexicans.
The Mexicans to invade the United States.
Ooh.
You know, the Mexicans were upset with the United States because of the Mexican-American War and the various you know, takings of Mexican land as far as California,
like Texas.
Arizona, Texas, and all that sort of stuff. And so there was this secret telegram that the Germans sent to them to Mexico and said, "Hey, we'll give you money and munitions if you just, you know, take care of the United States." And the United States found out about it. And so the United States, well, I missed a little part here. The United States complained very, very loudly. And Germany, not wanting to get the United States into the war at that time, backed off on the unrestricted submarine warfare.
Okay.
And then 1917 comes along, and they say, we're going to start it up again. Because Germany is starving, and, you know, the United Kingdom is not getting any starvation whatsoever. We're going to start this up again. And that, with the what they call the Zimmerman telegram, really got Americans up in arms about things.
Okay, before we get to what Americans do about that, we're at 1917 at this point.
Yes, 3 years into the war.
3 years into the war, and as we know, 1918 is when it ended. So in 1917, was the German side losing the war?
Well, it wasn't going well for Germany. It wasn't going well.
Okay.
But
the end wasn't in sight at this point, would you say?
Not immediately, no.
Okay.
You know, they could see that things were going badly for them.
Yeah.
But it was not. It wasn't total bad news. Russia was falling apart at that time. In 1917, you had two revolutions in Russia. You had a revolution in February. Now, this is Julian calendar, not Gregorian calendar, so it's a little bit offset.
Okay.
So the October Revolution, which was the Communist Revolution, didn't actually happen in October.
Okay.
Actually kind of spilled off into November. But they still called it the October Revolution because that's what their calendars were at the time.
All right.
And so
what was the other revolution? You said there were two.
Yes. Yeah, so the Tsar got overthrown in the February Revolution. That was a kind of provisional government got set up.
Which of those two revolutions is nicknamed the Bolshevik Revolution?
That is the later one.
Yeah, the
Communist. That was the October Revolution.
Okay.
And
so then what happened there in February? They who got rid of the Tsar?
It was an uprising.
Okay, the common people?
The common people. It was the military wasn't willing to fight anymore. Russia was really hard pressed before the war. It shouldn't have got into the war.
Okay.
But anyways, so
in 1917, between February and November, Russia is kind of a mess. It's in chaos.
Well, it sues for the provisional government in February, in March or whatever.
Yeah.
They sued for peace. So they gave up enormous tracts of land to Germany just to get peace. They couldn't handle the war any longer.
Okay.
Their country was in disarray.
Right.
So that was a kind of good news for the Germans because they could devote their armed forces to that, and so to the Western Front, and so they were doing that. For whatever reason, they really got the United States involved, and they thought the United States wouldn't be as effective. It would take time for them to come over.
Okay.
So they took the risk of America coming into the war.
All right. So the United States came into the war. Long story short, what?
So, the Americans come into war a lot quicker than the Germans anticipated.
Yeah.
France is being resupplied. Germany's United Kingdom is being resupplied. And it's really going badly for the Germans on the Western Front. And so, the war is coming to an end. I mean, the Americans were actually making territorial gains.
Okay.
We're pushing back the German lines, but the Germans were at the breaking point. They're starting to get mutinies in their army. They were getting mutinies, throughout. There were strikes. Eventually, the Germans knew that they just couldn't continue the war any longer.
So the war ended in 1918. Would it have been longer if the United States did not get involved?
Maybe it might have, but it was the handwriting was on the wall for Germany.
Okay, so Germany wanted peace?
Germany sued for peace, and so the armistice happened at that time. The Kaiser abdicated his throne, and the German government just said, "Okay, we got to go."
And this happened 100 years yesterday.
Yes, 100 years yesterday. That was the end of the war, but it was Europe after that was very devastated.
Okay.
I mean, France was devastated. Germany was devastated. Russia was devastated. The Ottoman Empire, devastated. It no longer exists. It eventually became Turkey. But, I mean, you had the fall. The Austria-Hungary got split up.
Yeah.
Pretty much what you see in modern times. Austria became a country. Hungary became a country. Czechoslovakia. Yugoslavia became a country.
Hmm.
So there was all these new countries that were made because of the breakup of Austria-Hungary.
So in the 3 minutes we have left, could you elaborate a little bit on why the World War I was not the last world war?
Well, because Europe was so devastated. In fact, we could say quickly that it caused the quick decline of religion in Europe.
Okay.
I mean, after wars, people start getting disillusioned, and it happened to America to a lesser extent after the Civil War. It really happened badly in Europe. A lot of Europeans lost faith. Germany was in turmoil. I mean, it set up the stage for Hitler coming into power. And of course, we talked about the Communist Revolution in Russia, and so all these sorts of things, this turmoil that was happening in Europe, you saw the rise of totalitarian nations that came about.
Is there any truth to the Treaty of Versailles? Was really hard on the Germans.
It was hard on the Germans,
and the Germans were resentful, and eventually this is one reason why somebody like Hitler did rise up.
Yes. It really did not give Germany a chance to rebuild. It kept on having to pay war reparations through the entire time.
Okay. So then it was only 20-some-odd years between World War One and World War Two.
Yeah, just a generation. Yeah,
just a generation between these. That's like a that's nothing.
It's really nothing. Yeah, and World War One was much worse than World War Two as far as carnage.
Really?
Yes.
Even though it was less technological.
Yeah. Well, I mean that the war of attrition. You had poison gas. We get the term shell shock.
Yeah.
From that period. So, what we call traumatic stress syndrome, it comes from, World War One shell shock. Mm. I mean, mm. you were finding soldiers that just couldn't transition to civilian life anymore.
Yeah, we only have a minute left, but maybe one of these days we could do a show on World War II, because this was interesting, and I'm still fascinated that it only took a generation between World War I and World War II to get going again. And a lot of people, wonder about World War III, and to me it's obvious, World War III is abortion.
Ah, interesting.
And that's really a world war that's going on.
That is the genocide, modern genocide.
Yeah. So let us hope and pray that all of our wars end, permanently.
Permanently. We can hope for peace, yes.
Last words?
Hope for peace.
Hope for peace. Okay. Thanks, Mr. Bob. It was an interesting conversation. Veterans Day Veterans Day 2018, 100 years after Armistice Day. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your active listening to this Beneath the Surface, and we will see you again, same time, same channel, next week. Have a great week, everybody.
BreadBox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at KaneFord.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at WoodhillCommunityCenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on Nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at LexusOfLexington.com.